This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the September 27th edition of the DRF Players Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, back with you alongside the usual crew from the DRF offices in Manhattan. We have Mike Hogan.
Hello, Pete.
And from Texas, we have Jonathan Kinchin at UT Big Hair himself. What's up, JK?
I didn't get much sleep last night. I was watching the circus late on TV.
I was going to ask you about that. I know, Jonathan, you being a master debater yourself, if you were interested in getting stuck into the debate and how it went. I had no idea because the only contest I was attuned to was the Atlanta-New Orleans game. I bet the over.
Yeah. Well, that was a good one. No, I watched it. And no, politics aside, I just like watching people in stressful situations and seeing how they handle them from like a personal, like personality standpoint. And that's why it was so interesting to me. I could care less. I mean, I care about the policy, but I just like to watch them do things in stressful situations that I find entertaining.
Did you make any judgments based on that, or it was more just like the pure, like you said, the circus/theater of it?
I made some judgments, but the one that I'm willing to probably share is, did someone from the Donald Trump camp not recommend to him that he should have took a Zyrtec? He was literally sniffling into the microphone the entire time, and I just can't believe that someone didn't help him out with that.
I lied. Of course, I did watch the damn thing. And I will make this one observation. If anybody on the show ever talks to me the way he did Lester Holt, we're going to have a problem. Mike Hogan, what did you think?
Oh, I only saw a little bit of it because I was in the process of putting a toddler to bed, and I happily missed much of it. So we'll just leave it at that.
I think that was probably the right move all in all. We had a great weekend of racing ahead of that. The big stuff happening primarily in Pennsylvania. Lots of debate to get into on that. We're going to get to some questions later in the day, but I want to start off at Philly. And Jonathan, I think the question has to go to you. You spoke very enthusiastically last week about your plans to take on Songbird in the Breeders' Cup Distaff with Beholder. After watching the Cotillion, do you feel the same, better, or worse about your idea to try to take down Songbird in that spot?
I feel the same. She won easily. She's a good racehorse. And but at the same time, it's exactly what I wanted to happen. I wanted her to have a performance that would lend her to be the favorite in that race. And from all, you know, opinions I've heard, it seems like that's probably the case. You know, obviously if Beholder goes out and buries Stellar Wind by 10 and in hand and blah, 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 that could change a little bit, but it seems like, well, I'm going to get what I asked for. And there'll be a Friday night in Arcadia, California, that I'll either be happy and heading to, Din Tai Fung or sad and heading to, In-N-Out.
There are many dining options at every end of the price chain when you get out there. I was thinking you were going to put Arroyo Chop House at the top end of that, but Din Tai Fung, always a good standby.
I was a late scratch for Arroyo Chop House, so I haven't seen it.
Oh, I forgot that. I forgot that incident discussed on a previous episode of the podcast. Mike Hogan, I have a fairly strong opinion on this. Let's get you to chime in first.
Well, I think I know what your strong opinion is, and my guess is mine is kind of in between the two of you. And I'll say this, I'm generally more in Jonathan's camp, which is she's a fantastic 3-year-old filly, maybe one of the best we've seen, certainly since Rachel Alexandra. At the price that she's likely to be, she needs to prove to me that she is good enough to beat those outside of her generation. It could be a case where we have one of the greatest fillies ever, and if so, you know, even money or whatever you're likely to get in the Breeders' Cup may very well end up being value. But I'm inclined to take
even money.
You think it's going to be less?
I do.
Really?
Before you go, Pete, I to Mike's point, I agree about the generational situation, but I also believe that those two fillies that she has been beating are good horses. Karina Mia, yeah, sure. I think, is special. And I think Catherine Sophia is a good horse in her own right. So,
yep.
I guess I'm agreeing. I'm disagreeing, but I'm still not changing my stance.
My point isn't that I think that Songbird's some great bet in the BC Distaff. I guess my point is, when it comes to Beholder, that there's got to be an easier way to get your 8-5 or whatever you're likely to get, assuming she goes on and wins in the rematch with Stellar Wind. There's got to be an easier way to get your $6 than taking on that freak. And to me, you know, ahead of the race, I was looking at prices in the UK, looking at the 11-4, it came into 5-2 after, and I was pretty tempted by them. But I have to say, something about watching her and the ease with which she did it, and this is what I want to segue into you guys talking about, the speed figure. None of her speed figures have come up fast. But to me, isn't this just super reminiscent of last year in another situation with a freakish push-button horse who always won under a double handful, who didn't run higher figures until the later part of the year when really asked to extend? I mean, it was harder with Pharaoh, too, because he was in several situations where figure-making was just rendered very difficult by the situations. I think the Songbird figures are probably more, like, to my mind, like, not that the Pharaoh ones were inaccurate, but I have more confidence in the dead-on-ness of the Songbird figures. I just think there's a lot more under the hood here, and for not a huge gain, I'm just not sure that's one I want to take on. That's my only point.
No, and I agree with that. And we've been around each other enough to know that there's a lot of creative ways that you can get 8-5 in a race without having to just play one horse. And so that's a phenomenal point, and a point that, to be honest, I hadn't really even thought of. One of the things that I'll say to that point, though, is that when you can get your return when you need one thing to happen rather than getting your return when you need two or three things to happen, then – you know, I tend to try to find those spots. And my mind also works that way because of, you know, being a multi-race player that likes to build his plays around finding a free square and a sequence. And so that's kind of where my mind is on that one.
I had a good chat with Mike Maloney yesterday. We were talking about this very issue, and he suggested that to his gut, that the 5-2 in the UK on Beholder right now is simply too big, and he's very tempted to take it with the thought that he'd then come back and just play a one-way exacta Songbird over Beholder as a saver. That's an interesting possibility someone with your opinion, Jonathan, might think about, except doing that suggests that Stellar Wind, when she stepped up and beat Beholder, that was just her day and she's not going to be able to replicate that. What do we think? By reducing this to the two-horse conversation that we have over the last 10 minutes, Mike, are we giving short shrift to Stellar Wind and her potential chances to be the woman in this division?
Not only to Stellar Wind, but we're also giving the short shrift to Carolina and even Cavorting. I mean, there's some good fillies outside of the ones that we've already talked about, and we've seen huge bombs come in the Breeders' Cup Distaff. We've seen favorites win, but I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think that many of the biggest prices in the Breeders' Cup history have come in the Breeders' Cup Distaff. So crazy things have happened. It's not like it's just going to naturally chalk out. There might be value created, and look, the best horse doesn't always win on any given day. You know, they can show up and just not be feeling right or just not give their A effort, get beat by a nose. You know, I mean, talk about One Dreamer, you know, things can happen. So
I hear that, but we're not talking about one horse having to have a bad day here. We're talking about two. I mean, to me, the number that comes to mind that one of Songbird or Stellar Wind is going to win this race, it's like 2-5 or less in my mind.
Yeah, maybe, I guess. But if you're getting outsized value on all others, then don't discount it. That's all I'm saying.
I think that I've always made this argument. I think it's perceived value. Like, you think it's value because the tote board feels like it's telling you it's value. But the truth of the matter is, with two fillies and mares, the way that Beholder and Songbird run, they're forwardly placed. They're going to make their own trips. They've shown that they can overcome pace situations. you know, it just doesn't, it feels like that they're going to win 70, one of those two is going to win 75, 80% of the time. Now, I don't know how that transfers into odds. Pete, you could probably help a little bit on that, but I'm not crazy about spending money on scenarios that are going to win less than 20% of the time.
Well, let me ask you specifically, Jonathan, before we can stay on this topic for a minute, but I'm curious specifically what you think about Stellar Wind herself, given that she has Beholder on the form book.
Yeah, I've never been a Stellar Wind fan, so I'm kind of it's kind of a bias. You're asking me a biased question because I've always tried to beat her. Like, I really, really don't think I've ever bet her. I'm pulling it up right now just to be sure, but I don't think I've ever bet her. I do think that she was on the good part of the Del Mar track in the last race. I thought Gary rode Beholder with too much confidence. And in my – we actually even talked about it. I speculated that there might be a jockey change after the ride that he gave Beholder. So, I forgive him for that race. I've never really been crazy about Stellar Wind. Back through her PPs, there's not a race where I was like, oh, I forgot about that race that she ran so well in. I mean, I just, no, I you don't actually really, really yeah. want nothing to do with her. Yeah, I mean,
Jonathan, I'm not a huge fan either. And I mean, you bring up points. The other point to make, Mike, before I'll let you get your deal in, but they did a great visual comparison. I think it was on TVG of just the fitness level of Beholder for that race versus how she came out in the Pacific Classic. And it matched everything Richard Mandela said publicly about her not being as tight, not being as fit. So that's another excuse on top of the point you made about the racetrack as to why Stellar Wind won't be beating Beholder again. Mike, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, Jonathan, I get your point about perceived value or false value, and I think I've maybe even said it on the podcast. Certainly, I say it every now and then, just outside of in regular conversation. You know, I can give you 500-1 or 1,000-1 on the Washington Generals, but that doesn't mean it's a good bet. So I get that. And you know, the other day I was pretty convinced, and I even said it on the podcast: 80% chance that Songbird wins, maybe more. And, you know, I played a small pick four that I actually tweeted out where I singled Songbird as a lone A. And at no point through the sequence was I ever worried that I was going to be losing, at least in that leg. So I get that. But I think the Breeders' Cup distaff is different. I mean, it's the first time she's faced older. It's the first time she's faced out of her division. And we don't have a scenario like last year where the best horses in the older division, you know, I mean, if Beholder had run, if California Chrome had run, if Liam's Map even had run, then we might be having a different conversation about what we saw with American Pharoah.
Oh, I don't think
but the
so.
Way, well, maybe, I don't know, but I'm just saying what you had there was you had a horse with a pace advantage, a speed figure advantage, and just brilliance. I don't think we have that here. And at even money or whatever she's likely to be, I'm willing to conceive the possibility that she's maybe better than these, sure, but the value that I get from going against her is too much to ignore. I mean, that's kind of why I'm on the Mike Maloney side of things. And yeah, Beholder is the most likely one, but I wouldn't discount some of the other options.
I think that, you know, obviously we'll be able to talk about this a lot more as we get closer to the day. It's going to be a race for me that that narrows down in a serious way. Jonathan, you mentioned the idea of 80% that one of the two of them wins. That'd be 1-5 is 83%. But think about it this way. If I told you you could get 17% equity on your money, surviving that leg with those two, I mean, I do that every day. I would probably look to do it in a pick type scenario, but heck, if I could lock it in the UK, I mean, to make 17% on your money that one of those two wins, that sounds okay to me.
Yeah, but see, I think in that scenario, you're also, you know, to if you're going to bet Beholder at 5-2 and then bet the exacta with Beholder and Songbird, you know, to me, you're needing that second place situation to still happen. And to me, the most, you know, why it took me so long to get to Exactas, I mean, I've eventually have gotten there. But the second place horse and the second place winner to me is always so unpredictable, you know, because so many things come into it. Like, you know, they're not trying to win, you know, at that point, they're not trying to win the race. So it's like they wrap up and they run third, or they get nailed late, or they got buried on the turn. You know, there's a lot of weird things, and it's just you're needing that second thing to happen. That's the only problem that I have with it.
Spoken like a true multi-race player, which of course I am as well. So I'm very sympathetic to to where you're going with that. Of course, the Cotillion wasn't the only Grade One on Saturday. We also just a little bit after had the Pennsylvania Derby.
That was a Grade Two, though, Pete.
Oh, that was a Grade Two. Oh, I for some reason thought the PA Derby was these days a Grade One. I guess attracting the top three finishers from the Derby, from the Kentucky Derby. Got my head wrong there.
Yeah, but you didn't see all the discussion about that?
No, I did not. Well, tell me what let's talk about that first, and then we'll get into the winner's performance and all the other implications.
Well, you know, Jonathan's buddy Nick Tamaro, I think, came out and said, you know, it's kind of ridiculous that it's still a Grade Two. And, you know, some people jumped in throughout some examples of horses that maybe are not going to be enshrined in the Racing Hall of Fame that have won it in recent years. But look, I mean, in the last few years, it's attracted some of the top three-year-olds in the country. I guess the argument against is in September to have a restricted three-year-old race, you know, maybe not, might not make it worth a Grade One. But
restricted Grade Ones, though, this time of the year, too.
Right.
That argument doesn't hold water.
Right, exactly. And the Cotillion right before it is the example to refute that. Yeah. Frosted, Bayern, California Chrome, you know, this year, a good field. I mean, the top three finishers in the Kentucky Derby, you know, I think it should be a Grade One. It probably will be going forward.
Yeah, well, Connect was terrific. I thought, I mean, he got a great trip. Gunrunner, you could certainly argue, ran the better race of the two. Happy that some podcast listeners were able to make a little bit of money based on our conversation. And hopefully didn't get sucked into the vortex of betting on Exaggerator. Jonathan, you're texting after, oh, yeah, see, I told you he's a one-turn horse. You picked him on the podcast. How deep in your cheek was your tongue when you're tweeting that? Or did you just forget?
Oh, no, it was very deep. It was supposed to be, I was making fun of myself.
You're supposed to make me crazy? Okay,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
I'm glad you took the starch out before anybody else could.
Yeah. You know, it's so frustrating. You fight it, you try it. It's like that restaurant you drive by on the way home all the time. You're like, this place is not going to be good. Then you're hungry one day and you go there and it's awful and you're like, God, I knew it was going to be bad. It's like it's that same feeling that I had when he was still finishing as they were crossing the wire.
What do we think is the story here, guys? Is this we'll start with Exaggerator. Are we looking at a finished product here? Are we looking at a horse who, as has been espoused on this podcast more times than I've said my name, needs to run around one turn? Is it a tactics issue? Mike Hogan, what do you think?
I don't know. I wish I knew. I think some of it is certainly a tactics issue. My concern, part of the reason why I liked him in this race, was the ride and the trip that he got in the Travers, which is the kind of ride that is never going to win any Grade One race. And then it seemed like, and I need to watch the replay a few more times and focus more on him, but it seemed like he got a very similar ride here. I mean, he lagged back early, he made a middle move, he swung wide, he had a little bit in the stretch, but he ultimately came up empty for the big prize. You know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it's a running in spots sort of thing, if it's a jockey error sort of thing, if it's just he needs to go shorter distances, if he's over the top, or some strange combination of all of them. I don't know.
Jonathan, are you sticking with the Malibu plan for this horse, or after these two dismal efforts in a row, do you think that maybe the ship has sailed for this one?
No, I mean, I think the Malibu is probably what they'll do with him. Like I said, I still think he's going to win the Met Mile next year. So, I mean, I just think that he's one of those horses that, in a very simple way of putting it, without overanalyzing the horse, he's just the type of horse. He's a good horse. And when he gets when he gets a favorable scenario that's to his liking, he can win a grade one race in a lot of different circumstances. And I think that's what he did. Mm-hmm. He likes a wet track. He likes a pace meltdown in front of him. And he got those things. And in the times that he got them, he won grade one races, or he was grade one placed. You know, he won the Preakness off of that scenario. He won the Santa Anita Derby off of that scenario. He ran second in the Derby on that scenario. And you look at the other scenarios, the Belmont, the Travers, the Pennsylvania Derby, and he's nowhere to be found without those scenarios. So I just think that he just needs a setup. He's a good horse that needs a setup, unlike other great horses that we've seen, or really good horses. They kind of create their own scenarios, which is one of the annoying things about the American Pharoah hate from last year, that he kept getting an easy trip. It's because he kept making his own easy trip.
Such a great
Exaggerator doesn't mm-hmm. have that. He doesn't have that tool in his toolbox of creating his own situation. He's always going to depend on others to get him to the winner's circle.
We also should talk about Nyquist. The original plan involved keeping him going, and I believe Mr. Redham even has a spot in the Pegasus come January. Do we think that spot's going to go to Nyquist, Mike?
Well, at least he's in training. We can't say that about Donworth, right?
Oh, I didn't realize. Is he done?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think he's worked since he was wasn't he a scratch from the Met Mile? I'm not sure he's worked since then. I mean, maybe I'm being a little cheeky.
Mike's the only person in America with Donworth as a stable alert.
So he can make me crazy saying how he's no good.
That's right. It's a mile and an eighth. It might be, assuming, you know, look, he's got to return to form somewhere, whether it's in Southern California. I don't know what you do with him next. I don't know if you keep on and go to the Breeders' Cup Classic. I don't know if you cut him back to the dirt mile. Well, I don't know. I mean, crazier things have happened.
Really?
Yeah. To Drosselmeyer? I mean, you know, there have been, look, this is a horse that's shown some talent. This is a horse that on his best day, if he gets the trip and gets, you know, the race shape set, you know, in a favorable setup, he's a good horse and he can win races. I don't think he really wanted to be rated, you know, and he just kind of ran around the track a little bit. I don't know what else to say.
Do you think we'll ever see him race again?
I mean, I tweeted afterwards, I think that there's a retirement coming soon, and I don't mean it to be, I hate being like conspiracy theory guy, but and speculating on people's intent. But here's my thing is like, he's a Kentucky Derby winning son of the hottest young sire in America. Like they're doing is tarnishing his value by continuously putting him on the racetrack and running him outside of the trifecta. Like, just, you know, say he's got a soft tissue injury. It's nothing, you know, not that big of a deal. And I feel like, you know, he's already been purchased, hasn't he? Didn't Godolphin or Darley buy him? You know, and let him go get his $25,000 a pop, and hopefully he can, you know, produce well as a young stallion and go on with it, rather than continuously putting him on the track to get beat up and have people like us talk about how he wasn't that good in the first place.
Yeah, the when you have a story that came out, you know, we both to varying degrees, or to some degree, I guess I should say, bought the story, the idea that he had growing up to do. But then to sort of go through that process, to come back on the racetrack and that's all you see, I think you're right. You get to a point now where there's a real anti-marketing possibility of your stallion, and I don't think that's in anybody's interest. So I would be in that camp, not to be overly cynical, but I'd be surprised to see him on a race course again, other than in a let the fans see the Kentucky Derby winner one more time leading the post parade scenario. But who knows? I have no inside information, and I'd love to be wrong.
And to answer your question about what's Redham going to do with that Pegasus seat, I've heard he's called over to Japan to see if he can get, I'll have another back under tack and get him back over here in time for the big race.
Where do you come up with this stuff?
That's what I would do.
Were you and Al have another fan? Was he a darling of yours?
Hell no, not even close. I hated that horse. I went to the Kentucky Derby. My first one was Mind That Bird, and I never left the Kentucky Derby with money. Never until American Pharoah. And the only time I was primed to make a little bit of money, I went to the ATM, took out the last dollar I had, like literally went to the ATM, checked my balance first to see how much I had in there, took every dollar I had out and bet it all on Bodie Meister to win.
Oh, Lord.
And I was counting my money at the eighth pole. I was like, holy, I'm a winner. Oh my God. And then he runs me down. Then I come back off of the fractions that Bodie Meister runs in the Derby. I come back in the Preakness with a small loan from my dad, probably because the ATM hadn't replenished in the 2 weeks between the two races. Loaded up again and got my soul crushed again.
Now, you know, it makes you wish there could be a special window some days, and maybe the people who bet Gunrunner on Saturday would want to be lining up at this window. The window to cash for when your horse was best, but you didn't win. I think you might have had a shot at that.
Absolutely.
I love it, Jonathan. You bet Bodie Meister in the Derby, and then you went back and said, "I'll have another in the Preakness."
Essentially,
yeah. Essentially.
What did we think of the top two in the Pennsylvania Derby, Mike? Who was best?
Boy, they certainly were the top two, weren't they? I mean, I think it's clear that they were the two best, or they ran the two best races in there. You know, I guess Gunrunner with the trip was probably the better of the two. But I actually tweeted it out. It's too bad I didn't think of it before we recorded the podcast last Friday. But I was realized in looking at Gunrunner's PPs, he's Tapicher. He's the second coming of Tapicher. This is a horse that runs well, but just finds a way to lose against the best of his generation. And he always gets bet, and he always runs a good race, but it's just not quite enough, right?
Unreasonable. I think there might be a little bit more in the tank based on the trip this time, based on
maybe.
Just the freak out of facing Arrogate. But I guess you could argue, well,
maybe.
See, there you go. Arrogate is just another level. But that leads
us
to the
finds
bigger,
another one.
The bigger picture question here, when we're looking at these three-year-olds, you have to vote for three-year-old of the year today. We're not looking, this is going to be a loaded and difficult question. We're not looking at what happens from the rest of the year forwards. We're just looking at what's happened to this point, going back to January. You're making your vote for three-year-old male. Jonathan, who do you pick?
When it's a close tie, I go with the Derby, I'd pick Nyquist. I was going to say Exaggerator, but it's just so close. If I had to pick today, I'd pick Nyquist. That's the biggest race for three-year-olds all year long. And if you win that one and the rest of it is a jumble behind you, I'm going to always go with that race.
I agree. It would be painful for me to click it, but I would click it. Mike, are you in the same boat?
Jeez, Pete, you start with the debate, and now you throw this one out. This is another hold-your-nose pick. But yeah, I'm with you. You got to hold your nose and pick Nyquist, knowing full well that the best of them is probably Arrogate.
Well, that was my next question, and we'll start with you, Mike. You've already tipped your hand, but maybe you can expand a little bit. Who is the best three-year-old male?
Well, I mean, look, you know, he's grown up. He's run probably the biggest race, certainly the biggest race of any three-year-old this year, undoubtedly, or certainly any three-year-old male this year. And I think if we saw the three top contenders facing each other in the Breeders' Cup in the same race, Arrogate would be one-fifth, if not one-tenth, the price of the other two. He's certainly the most likely winner. He's the one that seems to be most talented of them. It's just kind of a shame that he got good a little too late in the season to be considered, unless he runs huge and wins or runs second to, say, California Chrome in the Breeders' Cup Classic.
All right, Mike's put his parameters forth for what Arrogate needs to do. Assuming you agree that he's the best of the three-year-old crop of males, Jonathan, what exactly does he need to do to get your vote for three-year-old male?
Well, yeah, I mean, if he wins the Classic, I mean, it's pretty
much
over.
I think it's obvious. What about a second? I mean, what about a good third? Where do we draw the line here where that would put him over your idea of Nyquist? And what I said, too, Nyquist sort of holding the forgive me Trump when it comes to this division.
Yeah, I mean, look, when it comes to the Eclipse Award, I think I draw the line at the Exacta. Like, I don't care if you ran third. Like, I just when it comes to an Eclipse Award, I get it. You know, your stakes placed, that's great. But I think I draw the line at the Exacta when it comes to that. So if he runs third, nah, it's not going to make a difference to me. I think, you know, in that scenario, I would just, you know, probably still go with Nyquist or Exaggerator, depending on what those two horses do moving forward. But kind of to go back to your other question earlier, and the point has already been made, but I was still excited about saying it. If Gunrunner, which in my opinion, he was best that day, how damn good is Arrogate off of Arrogate? I mean, mm-hmm. Gunrunner yeah. looked mm-hmm. loaded in that race mm-hmm. in the Travers on the inside. I thought he was a winner, and Arrogate buried him. And
well, Connect flattered Arrogate too, right?
Absolutely. They sure. both did. So, yeah. You know, that horse is something special. And that'll definitely be a lot of fun. I know we haven't spent a lot of time talking about the Classic. It's kind of been the, you know, California Chrome has dominated the division. It hasn't been a great talking point, but I think as we get a little bit closer and they start to ramp up, it's going to be kind of interesting to see what happens with those two horses.
Well, I think you guys both make excellent points about the way that the form of that race was bolstered. When you're dealing with a horse like Arrogate, we don't have that many data points to go on. So to see, especially Gunrunner, I mean, your point is correct about Connect boosting the form too, but Connect wasn't really persevered with in the race, so it makes like a direct form line comparison a little trickier. Gunrunner fired and still, and then comes back and runs so well and still couldn't really get in the same zip code. I know for me at least, the result of the Pennsylvania Derby makes me think much more seriously about Arrogate as a Breeders' Cup Classic contender and somebody who could maybe, I mean, at the right price, be an appealing proposition to take on California Chrome. Let's talk about what the prices are right now, and I'll put the question to you, Jonathan. If you had to bet today and you were looking at the Breeders' Cup Classic and you've got California Chrome at 6-4, or Arrogate at 3-1, where would your money go between those two?
Those win prices don't really, neither one of them made me go, ooh. So I would, you know, try to come up with a creative way to be alive to those horses, or some type of an Exacta or pick or try situation using those two horses on top. And then trying to catch some value in second or third. I'm not trying to cop out of your answer,
no, that's
but
fair. Arrogate to me is too short at 3-1. You know, it's the same old thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's not just what price should my horse be. It's who do I have to beat? And to take on California Chrome, I want more than 3-1. In truth, 3-2 California Chrome doesn't sound bad to me at all. I think he's probably going to be odds on mm-hmm. in there based on, you know, obviously we'll see who all shows up. But looking at sort of the top 10 contenders and their prices, I'm kind of feeling Chrome is going to be odds on. That might be value. It's hard to take that price in a situation where it isn't non-runner, no bet this far out. But for me, I'd go Chrome between those two. Mike, what about you?
Yeah, I'm absolutely with you on Chrome. You know, and again, it's the same sort of thing as what I talked about with Songbird. You're going to have a horse who hasn't really proven it against the top older horses, and you know, at a short price in the Breeders' Cup Classic, you're hoping that what you see is good enough to beat those all of those horses, including California Chrome, including some of the other ones that might show up. And I don't really want to take a short price on a horse that I'm hoping will validate an opinion, especially what is it 9 weeks that he's training up to the race? Is that how long it was between the Travers and the Breeders' Cup Classic?
Sounds right. I mean, yeah, it's similar to when Trainer did it last year, granted with a much more seasoned runner, but
correct. Yes.
It doesn't. Does that worry you? I mean, it worries me in the sense of I'd love to have another line on how good the horse is by seeing him run another race, but it doesn't like worry me in the abstract. Do you feel like it decreases that horse's chances at all being trained up to the race, Jonathan?
No, it doesn't bother me at all. I mean, especially with someone like Baffert who's done it successfully in the past. I mean, obviously, like you said, a different horse, but no, that doesn't really throw me off. And to be honest, I kind of like it when there's more of a question mark. I feel like there's a little bit more value. I mean, if he runs in the awesome again and runs second or has kind of a bad trip or a little bit of a story as to why California Chrome beat him, or if he beats California Chrome, then where's your value on the big day and with the big pools and the championships on the line?
Yeah, it's going to be very, very interesting to see. Mike, you mentioned the idea of other contenders. I'm just flipping through these prices, and we talked about this a bit on the show last week. It does seem conceivable that this is going to be the chalkiest Breeders' Cup in history.
Mm-hmm.
Just the way these races narrow down. I mean, just looking at the other names on the board here, besides California Chrome and Arrogate at this stage, Frosted, Beholder, who we think isn't going to go, Melatonin, mm-hmm. American Freedom, who would seem about 50-50 to go, Songbird, who isn't going to go, Connect, Shaman Ghost, Dortmund, California Chrome 4-5 is looking more and more likely to me. Are there any names in that list or any other names that leap to your mind, Mike, who you or would be interested in targeting for the Classic this far out?
No, not that I'd be interested in targeting. I think I would imagine Opportunity goes, and he probably wants every bit of the 10 furlongs. I don't think he's good enough necessarily to beat California Chrome on the square. But you're right. I mean, I hope it's not. And someone tweeted, apologies, I can't remember exactly who it was, but I agree with him. Someone tweeted out, look, if horse racing Twitter had their way, we'd only have 6 or 7 horses in the Breeders' Cup Classic. I hope that's not the case. I hope Frosted goes. I hope we get 9 or 10 at least. And I hope it's a good field and a good race, because then it helps the price on all of them. But you're right. I mean, even at even money, California Chrome seems like by far to my mind the most likely winner.
I'm just envisioning Jonathan Kinchin's Breeders' Cup betting. I think there's going to be $100 or even $200 pick four, like 2x2x1x3 type situation. Does that sound about right?
I'm going all in, double all in on Friday. I'm going to go all in on Lady Aurelia, because how awesome is she? And then I'll be back with another all-in on Beholder. So we'll see. Hopefully I can be at about 25,000 by then.
I love it that I'm talking cash betting and you're monomaniacally focused on the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge, as you should be. And that's where your mind goes. Of course, we're in the heat of qualifying for the BCBC. We've got another qualifier on Sunday through DRF tournaments. If folks haven't been playing on the DRF tournament site, what are you waiting for? Tournaments.drf.com. We've got credit builders, feeders, matchup contests every day, Wednesday through Sunday. And then on the weekend, big qualifiers for big tournaments, including the upcoming Santa Anita Autumn Championship, which is October 8th. We have the last round for that this weekend. And we're running events for the Gulfstream Conquer the Crown contest as well. Jonathan, do you project to be out at Santa Anita for the October 8th contest?
I don't think so. I think the Giants have a T-ball game that morning, and so it's probably one I might need to miss, but maybe not. We'll see. It depends.
Now, I heard a rumor, Jonathan, that your son wore orange and blue to the first Giants practice. You have a Met fan? You have a young Met fan blossoming? Because I could talk to the kid, help him out.
No, he had on an orange shirt and blue shorts at his game, and I made a little bit of a sarcastic joke and said, I didn't know you were playing on the Mets, buddy. I thought you were on the Giants. So we'll get that straightened out.
You're gonna get the black, and you'll be rolling in the black and orange before too long.
Oh yeah, we'll get it corrected. I'm a big believer in look good, play good. So we got to get it sorted out.
Anyone who's seen those floods and funky sneakers you wear to the tournaments, Jonathan, knows exactly what you're talking about. For me, I'm gonna miss this contest because it's my half marathon that day, and I love my job, but I've gone to the last 3 or 4 Santa contests, and I think it's okay to take this one off. We'll have some spies out there so we can get some good updates on the at DRF tournaments handle. We'll certainly get an interview with the winner, but the race that I'm concerned with that day is trying to drag myself home in about 2 hours and 15 minutes across 13 miles in Brooklyn. But it does appear that I'm going to make it. I had the last major piece of work the other day, a 10-miler around Prospect Park. And the clockers weren't overly impressed, but I am at least long odds to make it into the starting gate, something I wasn't sure of a couple of weeks ago. So that's my story as far as that goes. I do miss training with you, Jonathan. Mike Hogan, you're a svelte figure in the DRF offices. What do you how do you keep in shape?
I walk a lot. I mean, I now that I live in Forest Hills, I don't walk to work every day. I take the train, but I walk to and from the train. That's a good 10, 15 minutes each way. 10 minutes off the train. I probably put 4 or 5 miles in every day of just walking.
It must be a bit of an adjustment for you having to deal with the train after being able to walk everywhere. Is it has it impeded your lifestyle, or do you just like throw on a podcast and get it done?
Yeah, that's one of the nice things about Forest Hills. It's only 4 stops on the express train, so it's not terribly long, and I just have to grit my teeth and I'm svelte, but I have to even make myself more svelte to fit in amongst all the crowded passengers. But you deal with it. It's not too bad.
Excellent. All right. Well, let's take the rest of the show today and answer some reader questions. We have a few good ones here. Let's start with one. I don't think the person meant to phrase it the way they did, and it ended up getting some hilarious chatter on Twitter back and forth. The question was something about how racing is dying and what can we do to make things better. And Nick Tamaro actually chimed in that racing is like Hyman Roth dying of the same heart attack for the last 20, maybe more years, which I thought was great, not just because all wisdom does in fact come from the Godfather, as my friend John Preachy likes to say. But, dying to me is hyperbolic to say the least, but there is no doubt that that things are transitioning and continuing to change, and that there might be some more pain and consolidation within the industry before it sort of finds its equilibrium. At the same time, there's plenty of people betting plenty of money and a lot of jobs that depend on the racing industry. And, but I think the meat of the question, the thing that I wanted to ask you guys about, was any specific ideas on what can be done to either keep racing's new place in the sporting landscape from slipping further, or perhaps better yet, even continue to grow it, if not back to the place of prominence it once held in the pre-television era of the 1940s, back to something that made racing fans feel that our little passion is more relevant. Mike, we'll start with you. Any thoughts on growing the game?
Well, I'm going to say two things that might sound contradictory, but they're not. I think racing needs to do two things, and how it does it is, I guess that's the big crux of the matter. It needs to better cater to the existing horse players that fund the game through the handle and through betting, and make it more attractive and appealing and easy to do so. And there's a number of ways that we can go on and on about that. Lowered handle. Lower takeout, exactly. So that's one thing. Then the other thing that they need to do is focus less on the gambling aspect of the game. And I said they would sound a little contradictory, but
you were
forgive
right.
me. They're Keep not. Going. They're not. Because let's use some examples. Recent horses. Last 10 years. Rachel Alexandra, Zenyatta, American Pharoah, California Chrome, Songbird. You name it. These are the kinds of horses, superstars, that get people interested in horse racing, that get people to watch races, to come to the racetrack. They get them interested in the game. And what does the industry say? What's the knee-jerk response when there's a horse like that? Oh, well, how did it increase handle? How did it increase betting? Are they betting? We need to find a way for the game to benefit from fans that are created by these superstars that are interested in the game that maybe aren't interested in betting. I don't know what the answer is, but there has to be a way to do both.
I would argue that I agree with you that short-term focus on handle, as if Zenyatta is going to change the handle the next year, or American Pharoah, I don't think that makes a lot of sense. I think it's a long game. And when I have the pleasure of interviewing more horse players than anybody, I think, in the world, maybe ever, in my role at Daily Racing Form. I'm talking to 5, 6, 7 horse players a week, sometimes more. And everybody's got their origin story, and there's a few elements in the origin stories that are common. Number one thing is people always talk about the uncle, the grandfather, the father, the mother, the stepmom, the third cousin twice removed, whoever it is, that person who went and took them to the track the first time and sort of indoctrinated them into our little world, our little culture. That is in 80% of the stories, I think at least. So as a complete tangent, you want to know what you can do to help grow racing. Find some young people who you think would be amenable to racing and take them out there and show them a great time. You know, you might want to pick and choose your spot a little bit carefully as far as that goes to make sure it's the most positive experience it can be. But that's something that each of us can do. But the other thing I hear an awful lot is folks will cite a horse, some horse that they fell in love with, whether it's, you know, Kelso all the way down to American Pharoah. But it's not like these people as 8-year-olds then the next year started handling thousands of dollars because they fell in love with Kelso. They weren't even old enough to bet. But just having these stars help get them stuck in, and the effects of that on handle didn't happen for 10 years in many instances. So for me, you know, where I absolutely agree with you, Mike, is that focusing on fan experience and letting these stars help create create fans for the long term is fantastic. But I would argue rather, and maybe I'm misinterpreting what you said, but rather than trying to figure out a way to monetize those fans only, I would consider it cost of doing business as much as possible and just try to get more and more people into the racetrack and let these people sit and enjoy the game for free. In the competitive gambling landscape that we have, where you can go to the casino for free, it annoys me to no end to have to go in. The idea that someone has to go into Saratoga and pay for this and pay for parking and pay for that. I'd like to see the doors thrown open more widely in a way to promote more fans coming in. And you're not going to monetize them tomorrow. It might be 10 years before you monetize them. But I think, to me, that's the smarter long-term play. Getting anybody in racing or in anything in, you know, any aspect of life to take the long view these days is a very difficult thing. Anyway, that's a bit of a filibuster, but Jonathan, do you understand what I'm saying? Do you think there's a point here that's valid, and do you have any other ideas that might help in terms of growing racing?
Yeah, no, I mean, you kind of set me up perfectly with what I was going to say, and I was actually fortunate enough last year, as much as I traveled, to be able to bring along some new friends that have never been to the racetrack before. And I think one of the biggest things that we have to remember is that, yes, we love it because of the puzzle. We love it because of the money. We love it because we've had that score that made us think that this could be a fun hobby that we can make money on, and that excitement of all that stuff. But to get people to the racetrack, we try to advertise that. You can win this, pick six carryover, blah, 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 blah. And they don't know what the hell that means. They understand I get a free drink with a $10 bet. They understand that as long as I turn in a losing ticket over 10 bucks, I can get a free beer. And me and my buddies can come out here and get after it all day long and have fun and watch horses run in a circle. And then they realize that they enjoy it, and then they want to learn about the game, and then they become handle contributors. And I think that the idea that, you know, you have to go to the racetrack and you got to pay $7 for a hot dog, and then you got to pay, you know, $4.50 for a beer, and like – And then we expect you to then play an exacta box because, you know, some guy you're standing next to that hasn't cashed a winning ticket says that's what you should do. Like, I think that you have to make it a fun experience, because that's why people do what they do. That's why people play fantasy football. That's why the NFL is what the NFL is, because it's fun. It makes people happy and they enjoy doing it and participating in it. And I think that we have to continue to make racing that and understand that it's not going to be an immediate return on those people coming in and those marketing dollars being spent, but it's going to be something you're going to get back. For instance, I've taken friends to Gulfstream, and no offense, I'm just being honest. I've taken friends to Gulfstream. We've sat in 10 Palms and we've had food and drinks, and our tab has come and it's been $180. That's fun. That's great. Okay, fine. But I've also taken people to the Eddie Logan and we've ate, drank, hung out with Arcadia, bet, got high fives. People, TQ remembers my friends' names that he's only met once. He invites my friends to go down to the paddock with him, and he teaches them a little bit of something. they want to go back to Santa Anita. Hey, I'm going to the track. Where are you going? I'm going to Gulfstream. Oh, I'll catch you next time. Oh, I'm going to Santa Anita. I'm in. Let's go. You know what I mean? And it's making it fun. Like casinos give away. I remember all the time people used to tell me drinks are free in Vegas. And that's not true. They're not free. You pay for them. But it sure makes you feel better that you think you're getting a free drink, doesn't it? There's nothing worse than like or better than busting out at the table and then waiting for your free drink that you ordered, but you're out of money. But you sit there until your drink comes and then you go try to sort yourself out. So it's just little things like that to make people feel like they're appreciated and welcome.
I love the little window we're getting into Jonathan Kitchen's financial life on this episode of the VRM Players Podcast. Hustling drinks in Vegas and waiting at the ATM machine. But
you can't tell me that you guys have never even.
I've been there.
I sat in a slot machine and act like I was playing just so I could get a drink.
Sports betting is the best for that because you're basically just sitting watching the game, you know. So that's my recommendation rather than the tables for hustling the free drinks out there. But you make a great point about Tom Quigley in particular. Racing can't, Santa Anita can't have a better ambassador than TQ and what they're able to do in terms of customer service out there. And it's a reason why I recommend to people to play in contests. You can start off on DRF tournaments that are a $20 feeder to get into Santa Anita's, the weekend qualifier for Santa Anita. If you qualify and win a seat there, you know, you basically started with 20. At that point, you'd have parlayed it into basically a package worth $5,000. But I don't want to say it's worth more than the money, but psychologically, it is in a way the VIP experience you get at a place like Santa Anita. And, you know, obviously we can't extend that to every single fan who walks in the door. But if that can sort of be the gold standard that we're all sort of working towards in terms of customer service, to be able to give people in some small ways better customer service experience, better VIP experiences at the meets where it makes sense. I think it's a great way to potentially grow the game. It takes an investment in people and in money that I'd like to think the sport would be willing to make. Let me ask you, Jonathan, how successful have you been overall? You've talked about all your friends you've taken out there. I mean, how many of them got in, just as one little barometer, like did you have anybody like get an ADW account after going to the racetrack with you? Or is that a bad example because you live in Texas?
It's a bad example because I live in Texas, but I do have a couple of friends that have gotten ADW accounts. But more than anything, when we're at the track, they'll take out a couple of whatever they can afford, a couple, maybe it's a couple hundred, a couple 20s, a couple thousand, whatever it is, and they'll participate. And they want to learn, and they like it, and they want to go, and you know the Derby has become something big to them, and they'll watch it if they're flipping through the channels and they see it on, they'll stop and watch it now. And so, you know, it's just making it aware and bringing out the awareness and letting people know that we're here, like, hey, we're a sport and we're something that you could have fun doing on a Saturday or a Sunday or even on a Wednesday, and that's the biggest thing, and I feel like. There's easy, simple ways to attract new people. But then I also think, like, I even saw Craig Burnick tweet it the other day. He said, we keep talking about needing new owners and needing new players. But at the same time, it's like, there's also an argument to like, why don't we spend that money on the people we've already got? He actually said, we have enough owners and we have enough players. Let's treat them well and we'll be fine. But we become hyper-focused on bringing new people to the game with all these little gimmicks and stuff. I think it's simple. You shouldn't have to pay for food and drinks when you're at the track. I don't know what the mathematics are of that. I've never ran a track before. But if you can somehow, you know, show that you're participating, show that you're betting, blah, 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 then maybe you should be able to enjoy the day for free.
Here's my idea. And Pete, I get where you're going with free admission and free parking and Jonathan free drinks and everything. But no, look, instead of that, give in exchange for parking, in exchange for admission, in exchange for drink, in exchange for food. Give vouchers for people to use to bet the races. You know, I mean, some people will go cash them in for cash and it'll be like it's free drinks or whatever. But many of them will end up betting those vouchers and many of them will end up hitting those bets and then continue to bet them. And, you know, there you go. So that would be one easy way of doing it.
I don't know, easy in terms of the logistics. And boy, if there was a way to do it where you couldn't just I'd feel so much better about that idea if it wasn't talking about money that could be pocketed, but somehow had to be run through the machine once before it could be turned to cash. Nothing is easy in racing with the state of the technology.
Right. Sure.
But I mean, I think you're on the right lines of creative thinking that sort of finds the middle of the goalpost between the ideas that Jonathan and I were espousing. So
here's another idea. And, you know, lowering takeout is a very thorny subject for a lot of people. Owners, horsemen, trainers, you know, a lot of their purses are funded by the handle and the higher takeouts. Sometimes some people believe lead to higher purses, and they're afraid of experiment.
Correct, but I'm not doubting believe that.
Absolutely. So here's what you do: you don't lower takeout. You seed certain pools on certain days. Instead of a $100,000 guaranteed pick four or a $500,000 guaranteed pick six or whatever it is, seed the pool. Make an instant carryover, which is in effect a takeout reducer. And it also is a fantastic marketing vehicle for getting people to play those bets. I mean,
very interesting idea.
How many times do we talk about an Arlington pick four carryover? Now I'm going to look at Arlington. Because it's essentially a takeout reduction for those bets.
But it's better in a way because it also creates interest around it. In a way where I think that maybe politically you could get away with it more. I think the real problem with takeout reduction is the political football, the political nightmare of places wanting to reduce their takeout, and then the simulcast site won't take them anymore because their cut goes down, and it just becomes a very ugly thing quickly. It takes a marketing guy to think of stuff like this. We should throw that to some people in the industry and see if they think that dog will hunt, because it's a very interesting takeout workaround.
It'd be awesome if we had this conversation. I'm sitting here having it thinking, like, I wish I had our buddy Tom Lute on, who has run a racetrack before, has been on the breeding side, has been on the owner side. And these types of conversations will come up around him when I'm with him all the time, and he has an answer as to why or why it won't work. I'm not saying that he's got the right or wrong answer, but he's got an answer as to what the problem is. Oh, well, the horsemen are going to say this. Oh, you can't do that because the CRHBC or whatever they're called won't let you do that.
A legal issue or some regulatory issue, things like that. But it's worth running it up the flagpole with Mr. Lute, that's for sure. Guys, we only have a couple minutes left, and I did want to get to one more topic just because we said we were going to talk about it this week, and it has to do with this new Del Mar pick six situation. Jonathan, you've had some time to think about it. Do me a favor, give a two-sentence explanation of what they're doing for folks that might not know, and let me know your thoughts on if you think it's a good idea or not.
Ooh, Mike might be better for the explanation, so I don't screw it up.
Okay, Mike, you go.
I'll give the explanation. So in the past, after takeout, which is not changing based with the new rules, but in the past, the way it worked was 70% of the money to be returned to the bettors, 70% was returned to those holding 6 out of 6 tickets, and 30% was returned to the conso 5 out of 6. The way it works now is the 70% is still returning to those that have 6 out of 6, 15% is going to the conso 5 out of 6, and if no one is holding a single winning 6 out of 6 ticket, the remaining 15% is pushed into a pool that carries until someone hits a single ticket or until a mandatory payout on the last day.
Excellent explanation. Jonathan, do you like this idea?
Like I said last time, I like innovation. I like trying new things. I don't know yet because I got to see how it works. Here's what I do like about it. I like the idea that they kept the minimum $2 because I think that it's trying something different. You know, the jackpot situation got kind of weird because it never really seemed – it felt like with the jackpot situation, it was designed to always get to that final day of a mandatory payout because it's impossible when everyone can afford to cover all of those combinations. I think that having a $2 scenario will actually tighten that, and they won't get to that end of the meet with this crazy, unbelievable carryover where all this money is being tied up for weeks and weeks and months and months and months rather than it kind of recirculating into the bettor's hands. So I feel better about that part of it. At the same time, I'm a little bit worried if I'm wrong and it does get to a huge final day carryover. I don't feel like all of the bettors who originally participated in it can afford to actually take a legitimate swing at it late.
That's a good view of the pros and the cons. Mike, I'm sorry. What did you say the takeout is on this bet?
Oh, I don't remember. Sorry. Okay. I just know whatever I just know it's not changing. Normally. Yeah, it's just not changing.
It's the same whatever as what the other pick six takeout was. It's not like the crazy effective takeout that we were seeing in some of these other rainbow situation. So let's just keep our eyes on that. I think that's a good overview for now. We don't need to go too deep into it. It reminds me we should have a conversation about low minimums and the real world effect of low minimums on a show coming up. Folks don't seem to mind when we get deep into the weeds and get wonky about some of this industry stuff from sometimes, as long as we, you know, go over the races and keep giving out winners, because once again, you guys both had some good ones last week, and we know from Twitter that people benefited, and we appreciate that. But that's about all the time we have, unless either of you guys have a quick final thought.
Well, this Thursday, Pete, you and I will be doing another webinar on using trainer stats to find horses to either bet or bet against. We'll be joined by Scott Carson and Kevin Cox. That should be a fun one. So keep an eye out for that on DRF.com or in your email. Sign
Scott,
up, of course, join us.
Won the Saratoga contest. Kevin, well known from the Horse Player Show, and was a very entertaining guest when I had him as part of the idea stall for Mike Hogan, the Horse Players Cast reunion at the end of Saratoga. We should have a blast. I know Kevin has some interesting ideas, and Scott, of course, formulator, a big part of his game as well. JK, final thoughts.
The weather is changing here, and I'm happy about that. So
no longer 9,000 degrees every day.
Man, I tell you what, I'm tired of sweating.
I like it. It's tired of sweating out pick sixes, tired of sweating in Austin. Jonathan Kinchin, I want to thank you for your participation today. Mike Hogan, of course, as always, fantastic job. Thank you. Most of all, I want to thank all the listeners for tuning in, downloading wherever you find your podcast. Just a little reminder, we can use some more iTunes reviews, folks. If you feel like helping us out, go on there, pop in some nice words, some mildly critical words, really whatever. I just want to see more than the 8 reviews we have on there. It'll make my ego feel a lot better. Also wanted to give a special shout-out at the end of the show here today to my friend Sean Borman for helping put me over the top on using Connect in the Pennsylvania Derby on Saturday. It's significantly possible I would have screwed that one up without for you, Sean, so thank you for that. We will be back on Friday with a preview of the weekend's races. Until then, may you win all your photos.